Today we are going to be discussing Ellie and the Rogue Trader, and I'm very pleased to have Elaine Eisenman here to lead us in this discussion. Elaine Eisenman is a member of a board of directors of the public company DSW, and for those guys in the room who don't know what DSW means, that's Discount Shoe Warehouse. And DSW operates 500 designer show warehouses, and they're in 44 states. For 9 years, she served on the board of U.S. Trust. Is that
U.S. Tobacco?
U.S. Tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, U.S. Tobacco. I thought U.S. See,
everybody
knew. Yeah. Elaine is the founding member and a member of the boards of the Women Corporate Directors, and also the Belizean Cove.
Belizean Grove.
What is the Belizean Cove?
Belizean Grove is a group of a global group of women who sit at various high positions across all industries, arts through corporate, gathered from around the world, mm-hmm. to share ideas and networks.
Very, very cool. Elaine is also an author, and I'm holding up her book. It's called Betrayed, which she wrote with Susan Stroutberg. And Elaine's brought some books and has signed some books if any of you would like to purchase the books. It's called Betrayed, A Survivor's Guide to Lying, Cheating, and Double Dealing. It's under consideration for a Netflix series. Elaine was previously a dean at Babson College. She has a PhD in organization behavior from New York University. So at this point, I'd like to give the microphone to Elaine.
Thank you, Larry. Delighted to be here. What we'll be talking about today is Ellie and the Rogue Trader. This story, like as are all the stories in our book, is a true story. It's written in the words of the person who underwent it, who was the CEO of this company. And when we finish the discussion about Ellie and the Rogue Trader, I will read in Ellie's words exactly what happened and how she behaved and what the aftermath of the story is. So I'd like to begin with some questions that are open for all discussion. The first question is, based on what you've read, what, if any, red flags could Ellie have seen? One of the important pieces that we've discovered about betrayal is that there are red flags, but people typically miss them and don't necessarily connect the dots. So as board members and as corporate leaders, it's really critically important to become more aware of what might have been seen and anticipated in advance of the event. So all of you, what raised your hackles as you read this case? Mike?
I think what is fundamental in terms of producing red flags in situations like this is not related to activities and events. It's related to process and how the design of an operation like this currency trading is structured and staffed. If that's not done right, that's the first red flag, and it should shut everything down as soon as you see it.
So, Mike, what does it mean to be done right?
You have to have separate, independent functions in an operation like this for operations, trading, and risk management. Ellie was absolutely right. The only solution for preventing things like this is transparency. You can't have a closed trading book, you can't have confirmation slips in the bottom drawer of the desk, etc. Everybody in the organization, the various units, have to be able to see what's happening in the trading book.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Other observations?
I would say his notion of it, the word in here was island, immediately red flag, dangerous, walled off, lack of transparency, as Mike said. There seemed to be a dichotomy in here, too, that seemed to justify some exploration. It was labeled as not core, and yet there was a statement from the board that we need this. So I don't know how something could be not core, i.e., let's not worry about it very much, and yet we need it somehow, key to the growth. And those two different viewpoints of apparently the same thing. So seem to me to need a lot of exploration and reconciliation.
So that might be another red flag, is that discrepancy.
Sure would be to me reading it, yeah.
Others?
So has she been there for 2 years? Is that what I read?
She has been there for 2 years.
Responsible for this.
She was responsible for this.
So the annual audits, when people go on vacation, I don't know what Mike calls those things, but they make sure that for 2 weeks that person is not around so they can check his book.
Yes.
Things all fell through.
That's actually banking law for commercial banks. It's not just a business practice. You're absolutely right.
So none of those things happened?
None of those things happened.
All right, so going back to who's going to be responsible, you haven't gotten there yet, but she was in charge and all these things failed. And so even though the board could say, give her some direction, she should have, since she's an experienced leader, I think she should have really held fast to the fact that you cannot check, cut your checks and balances, you've got a fiduciary responsibility.
So she shirked her responsibility?
I think, well, she accepted the first no she got, and like she went away, ignored it.
But I think other red flags, this whole intimidating of sabotaging other employees, and never really questioning that. So there's not only processes in place that were broken or not adhered to, but there's also some cultural things.
Fortifying the island.
Right.
Well, just to make a little comment, Brent, there's a case that people may recall from many years ago, a Barings Bank, a very famous British institution, that was brought down by a rogue trader in Hong Kong, a guy by the name of Nick Leeson. And the reason that whole thing was able to implode is that the chain, the reporting chain, were all tied into a compensation system that was leveraged off of this trader's performance. He was doing crazy things, but he happened to be in a momentum stream before the Kobe earthquake disrupted the markets. Everybody was getting rich. Nobody wanted to stop this.
I mean, it just seems to me that when you're looking at your risks, right? Currency trading is has the potential for great risk, and where you have great risk, you should people mentioned transparency. We need to have controls and oversight, and it is just a complete sort of failure to recognize what was a great risk and what the intention was.
So, what would you recommend she have done?
I would have sent the internal auditors in, the CFO, the CFO, and said, let's understand what we're doing here. You can't, you have this huge risk, potential for great exposure. You need to have great controls and visibility.
Actually, they might even have done that, and it might not have worked, because if this was truly a non-core activity, the internal auditors may not have looked at the right things. This is a case when you have a very esoteric activity going on in a firm, you want to use the outside auditors to have a look at it, because they'll bring in an expert that understands the processes. You don't want to use internal audit for a small, in terms of their overall scheme of the business.
And that's actually what happened, Mike, is internal audit said, it's cool, leave it.
So,
Robert?
A couple of thoughts that I have, and some of this is her problem. So she steps into this job, she's hired by the board, and the board says, we have this unit, but don't worry about it. It's good. We need it. Don't pay any attention to it. So that, to me, would be, wait a minute now. So you folks are telling me that we have this unit that can kind of do it once. Frankly, I would have negotiated keeping it very close. And if there were, let's say there were monthly reviews, I might make them bi-weekly with this unit just because I don't know much about it. Now, raises the other question. When the board is responsible for PR strategy at the end of this mess, that scares the hell out of me. Since when does the board have the responsibility to decide what our PR strategy is? Now, maybe in some industries that's practice, but at the same time, how close are we to what's going on to deal with this story, and for the board to say, we've made the call, no comment, we're going to kind of figure this out, at least by my read of it. It really felt like, I don't know whether she had the board's support or whether the board was looking to throw over the side fairly soon. That was my takeaway.
So let's put the PR, the board and PR strategy on the back burner for a few minutes. And what I'd like to do is follow up on your comment about whether or not at the moment of hire, or at the time of hire, there was something that Ellie could have done to bring this into the mainstream and ensure that she it didn't become an untouchable.
I'm not that familiar with financial institutions, but in any company that does anything on the board, I mean, one of the first questions is, what is your exposure? What is your risk? And oftentimes it's pure mathematics. I mean, how much capital do you have at risk, and what's the statistical distribution of what can happen, and what can we tolerate? And I think if you run a financial institution, that gets elevated to the top.
So with that as backdrop, what should she have done?
She should have gone and look at all the activities that she's involved in, and figure out what is the risk. What is the capital at risk? What are the probabilities? What is the black swan? And really have a good handle on what's happened.
Ben, I think you had your hand up before.
I had another question unrelated to this one, so.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think someone said during the last meeting, so I'm kind of new to the whole board CEO management divide here, right? And I think someone said in the last meeting, the role of the board, I think, was nose in, fingers out. This seems very fingers in to me. From a board perspective, managing PR, saying this unit is off limits. So I was kind of curious about where that divide, any opinions on where that divide is in this case?
Great question. People, what do you think?
I think it's going to depend on the company, what their issues are, what's been the past practice. And some companies have different needs to be that close. I personally wouldn't want, Bart, if you were saying nose in, fingers out, I would personally, if I was running the thing, want it to be nose in, fingers out, and not have them so involved. But you've got a special situation, so to think that, who said it, maybe it was Robert, but I would imagine it's going to be micromanaged pretty closely while it's in the crisis mode. And board members are going to feel that they can ask any question and make any comment they want.
I think even before the crisis occurs, right, if I'm the executive, if I'm Ellie in this case, right, I want full visibility and everything. The board to tell the executive that this is off limits, you can't touch it.
You cannot have non-core and important to the board.
Right. Exactly. Right.
And are you sure, though, are we sure that she was told this, and you could negotiate it up front? It could have been an oh, by the way thing by the second week you're there. Oh, by the way.
Yeah.
And it's harder to achieve. It's harder to straighten out.
It also says the board. You don't know who the board is. Is it the board, the full board, or is the board the former CEO who's now become chairman of the board?
Right.
Because, if you're negotiating, you're probably negotiating. You're not negotiating the whole
board. It was
board.
His pet one unit.
Yeah.
And Joe, you're spot on. It was the CEO. It was the former CEO who was the chairman of the board. So that was his baby, which intensified and sort of politicized at writ large the situation around this group.
I think everyone was focused on the risk, which is really you've got a unit that's doing currency trading, so inherently it's hugely risky.
Right. And so when she came on board and questioned it, she was told he keeps an eye on it. It had been started. Don't you worry, it'll be fine. And that as long as he was chairman of the board, there wouldn't be a problem.
Is he still chairman of the board?
No.
was he at that time?
Yes.
At the time of the
then there's not a problem.
Yeah, he was the chairman of the board at the time of the crisis.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly.
Well,
they're definitely setting her up.
Well, but it also points out now the board is not, it doesn't look at the overall picture. They've got dysfunction here. They built in and allowing you to wait with it. Now you've got millions of losses because of it. I would assume that had to be an element.
Yes, that's exactly right.
How big were those losses, compared to the overall sort of picture?
Unfortunately, I don't know. They were significant. They were very significant.
Okay.
enough to put the company in turmoil.
But the company was big enough to survive.
It was big enough to survive, and is thriving now. So it made its way out. So this raises the question of, if you're interviewing for a CEO position, and you come to a situation like this, what are the right questions to ask? How do you prevent yourself from coming into a situation that is fraught with danger?
Now, are we aware that this happened when we're the interviewee?
No, you're Ellie. If you were Ellie.
What is off limits?
Is asking what is off limits.
The sacred cows is a term that you'll be.
Okay, so what are the sacred cows? Right.
Had she asked that, would she have been told?
That's
maybe, yeah. Maybe not. It's still a good question.
2 weeks later, they'll tell her.
But the fact that you ask it doesn't mean you get a straight answer to it. Yeah. If there's
assuming that we're that I'm under non-disclosure in this negotiation,
right?
I'm going to ask for financials, P&L, and a number of other things, so I can see kind of what's going on here, and maybe get some help to discern them if I don't have a strong financial background, but just to kind of know what goes in, what goes out, what are the sources, what kinds of things are going on. Assuming that this is some kind of a financial services firm that does currency trading.
Right.
If it's not my expertise, then I want to get somebody to help me because this is going to be out of my wheelhouse. But I'm on the hook as the CEO, right?
Right.
So I would want to know, do a little bit of my own due diligence. Now, maybe it's just because of my wiring. I want to get as much information as I can. I might weigh in and certainly ask the question that Kevin raised, but I may not get a straight answer. Are there third rails? And the answer is, oh, no, everything's fine. Well, in fact,
that's dangerous.
Right.
Exactly. So I have to do my own homework and then figure out, okay, what's going on here? And if the previous CEO had been courting her for the job, hopefully, she's paying attention and she's, is there something funky going on here? I mean, I think a lot of this stuff is trying to find some data, and a lot of it is gut. Does this pass the smell test?
Right. So she comes from financial services. She had a strong finance background. She was being courted by the former CEO, who was transitioning to chairman, and she did review the financials, and everything looked kosher. When she came on board, she was uncomfortable about this little group because she identified the potential risks of a small little don't worry about it currency trading group. But there were no red flags when she came in other than her gut saying, the fact that he said he's taking care of it, not to worry, everything is fine. I can go about the business of everything else without worrying about it. Was a red flag from her, but because he was staying on the board, she believed it was okay to come on. Mike?
I was just going to observe that what you're talking about in an operating business is a good rule of thumb, but what they had here was a trading business, and the financials can be extremely deceptive because businesses like this very often don't scale up because of liquidity problems in markets, and this could have looked like gold at the level they were running the business. And then after she came in and the economy got even stronger because this fellow Andrew probably wasn't being looked at every day the way he was in the old regime, when the guy knew what was going on as an operating manager instead of a board chairman. And so you suffer some losses. And the way you get rid of losses in a trading business is to scale up your business because the next trade is going to work out.
Double down.
Exactly.
So going back to what she could ask when she's coming in the door, what a candidate could ask.
Right.
What happens to the standard that the former CEO leaves the board? So that the new CEO is not under obligation or is not under this person's thumb to do it. We used to do it this way. You should do it that way.
You're absolutely right. He described it, the board described it to her as a transitional role, that he would stay on board to help her, and then he would move on. Unfortunately, there was not a time frame on it, which might well have been something that she needed to look at. Yes. Right.
And will be until he departs.
I mean, there are so many examples of the longest transition out on the planet where people come up with every conceivable excuse as to why they keep having to go back in. I think it was, what was it, Al? Yeah, Al Dunlap. Didn't he have like five times where he couldn't, he was about to leave and then he couldn't leave and he came back in and then he was back in again? So unfortunately, it's not an SEC regulation. It's a best practice, but there's nothing one can do about it other than say, I won't take this job if the CEO remains as chairman of the board.
Is agility something you should think about as a red flag, as an incumbent CEO?
I would think so, because...
I would agree.
It's not a best practice.
I think there's a tradition in the United States that after these presidents, the new president is inaugurated, the new president escorts the old president on a red carpet to a helicopter, and the way he goes, and I think that's the way it should be done.
However, it's pretty common to have ex-CEOs still on the board.
Right.
And I was to negotiate that.
That to stay?
They had to leave.
Oh, that they had to leave.
And once I got the financing, then he had to leave. So, and I did that for CFO.
So then what does that say also about the board that she came into? It's a compliant board because it was the CEO's board. And so, and she brought in no new board members.
You don't know if she asked for any either.
She did. And they were looking at term limits and staggered boards, and so ultimately they were going to be, the governance committee was looking for new board members, but it did not occur during this period.
Was Ellie a first time CEO?
Yes.
Were the board members, were they mostly insiders and highly held folks as opposed to independent?
They were all independent board members.
And this is a publicly traded entity?
Yes, it was. But she had been president of a significant division, but this was her first independent public CEO position.
Any idea what kind of compensation these independent directors are getting?
No, I don't know that. Why? What? How is that important?
Anxious to their incentives.
Right, exactly.
$200,000 to $300,000, maybe not anxious to leave.
Right, right.
Or whatever the number is.
My experience has been that with longtime board members, no one is ever anxious to leave because that's part of many people's retirement plan.
One of the things, if you turn the clock back and advise Ellie, one of the questions to ask the board is explain the process of board of directors self-evaluation, which is required by New York Stock Exchange companies, but they don't say what you do in board self-evaluation. So it ranges from, well, we have a kind of checklist and we just spend 5 seconds checking things and then we go play golf, to a very systematic board self-evaluation. I suspect if Ellie had asked the board to explain your board self-evaluation, they probably would have said, we don't believe in that, we don't do that, or it would be some sort of little checklist. But right. If they were doing a really thorough board self-evaluation, I suspect they would have more turnover on the board and it would be a different board.
Right, right. Exactly. Other challenges that you see in this case, wearing either Ellie's hat or the board hat?
Here's just a wild. When she came in, may want to check that PR firm out and see if it's just straight PR, if they have past practice or experience at crisis management. And some of these firms do have a hybrid called PR, it's an investment management, investor relations company. And so it's one of the things that I don't know how well prepared they were when they went to this no comment. It's just been a standard knee-jerk reaction by the PR firm.
Right. Right.
Rather than having somebody in fact that this his name is this chill this chiller or something like that and you are probably not there anymore, but you know, the copy of their lives and a couple of those firms. That's who you want to be right on your side during a crisis like this.
There's a firm, Temin and Company, which is a crisis management firm that gets brought in a lot of these massive blow-ups to help them figure out how to make it through. But your point is extraordinarily well taken. No comment, it always is the biggest problem that anyone can do. So Ellie was right on that, based on crisis management protocol. Robert? Yes.
It sounds like there's a criminal activity going on here.
There was.
So, you know, no comment. Criminal activity seems to be a bit odd because I've got, as Mike was saying, with this Leeson guy from Barrington Company, you know, I can throw somebody on the bus right away, right? From a PR standpoint, which, you know, the no comment thing sounds like, okay, you know, we're going to look bad for something.
I mean, I don't know exactly what, you know, when she's meeting with the head of risk management. At that point, you don't know if the head of risk management's involved. I mean, there's a lot you don't know in the first part of the conversation.
Right.
When the problem is just becoming obvious. But as you say, the answer to the outside world that the investor and so the regulators can never be no comment. It has to be, here's who we're bringing in, here's the process we're following. We may not have the answers yet, but here's what we're doing together.
And that's why she dug in her heels, because she knew that she would be seen as complicit the minute no comment came out. And her belief was the reason the board wanted no comment was because the CEO was complicit. And they were trying to protect him. And so she was the perfect scapegoat. But because the FBI was called in, she felt it was critical to get that information out to soothe shareholders and help people understand the gravity of the challenge. And that's where the board dug its heels in. So you have Ellie on one side saying, we have to tell the story, and the board on the other side saying, we need to manage it, it'll die down. And she's saying, nothing like this ever dies down. And we need to identify the actions we're taking, or else we have no hope.
Is there a regulatory body concern here associated with something like this? Again, this is not an area of expertise that I have, but worried about shareholders. But there's a whole sea of regulators.
So you start with the SEC.
Yes, start with the SEC.
I've got many regulators.
Right, exactly.
There's a whole ton of them. So
well, she was having the conversations internally, but there was a gag order on virtually anybody that knew anything about what was going on. Her push was to get it out there.
To whoever needed it.
To whoever needed it, and to get it into the press, to get it on CNBC, to get it into the media as quickly as possible, so there would be a sense of, yes, there's a fire burning, but the firefighters have arrived, and this will be put under control.
Seems
Joe?
Putting aside reputation and board and who's to blame, as a financial institution, it's pretty thinly capitalized. So you typically require pretty heavy debt. And your access to the capital markets is really core to the functioning of that organization going forward. I'm not familiar with that, not familiar with banking financial institutions, but it just seems to me that you've got to calm the markets to have access to business going, otherwise everything else can start unwinding on you very quickly.
That's exactly right, and that was her point. I mean, but if you think about, and this certainly is not this case, but if you think about what happened at MFS Global, where with Corzine, where everything blew up, but it took a long time for everybody was in hiding, there were no comments. What was there? There was $1 billion in investor money that was missing. And the way the media did not treat it as horrifically as one would assume. And so they only let out little teeny pieces of information during that whole period of time. So this, in some ways, was so much smaller than that debacle where investor money is missing, that you have to work.
Is there an obligation to have material information out to investors just under SEC regulations at some level?
But I don't know what there is, but I don't know what the timing is of that in terms of how long you can buy time.
It can't be very long.
Right.
Because then you've got insider trading going on, you've got all kinds of other businesses that grow
exactly. Right.
Lenny, we've got about 20 minutes left. I'm wondering if you could tell us what actually happened in the case, and then maybe we can generalize and discuss broader issues.
Absolutely. So I would. So I have Ellie's statement here about what happened. She refused to go quietly. She would not be scapegoated for a problem she did not create. She believes that the betrayal was aimed at throwing her under the bus, destroying her reputation, and so she went into battle mode to protect it. And she went to the board and said, quote, "I'm on to what you're doing. I'm not afraid to go to the press, the shareholders, and everyone in the industry who it was that insisted on my continuing with these business activities, and who insisted on providing the oversight that completely missed the fraudulent activity. I have proof, I have a paper trail, and I refuse to be the scapegoat. Then she goes on to say, my strength resulted in my victory. A flurry of management terminations followed, but I was not one of them. I dealt with the painful details of the failed systems and controls as I put new ones in place. I refused to be terminated. I was keenly aware that my attitude and demeanor would send a critical signal for all of those who worked for me, and I was not about to abandon them. My innate sense of fairness would not let me walk away from the mess. I stabilized the company with my key team members who were innocent of the situation, and I left the company once I was convinced my work was done. As testament to her courage and to her contribution to the company's ongoing viability, she was immediately recruited for another CEO position. In the face of total organizational betrayal, says Ellie, I maintained a firm grasp on my end game and my self-esteem. Even though I was attacked, bruised, undermined marginally, and attempted to be silenced, I disabled those who wanted to steal my power and control. I knew that strong leaders don't fold when the world around them is in tatters. And most importantly, I learned never to let an individual or an institution control your narrative, because it's your reputation that's at stake, and that means everything that's for your future. So she took hold of the situation.
So she didn't take the role.
The CEO, the former CEO, and the trading manager, and the trader. And that whole group was blown up.
Did she change out any board members?
She changed out all the board members.
All of them?
Mm-hmm. And she left on her own terms from a very different company. She needed to ask for their resignations. She couldn't push them out. So the board as a whole resigned, and the board as a whole was replaced.
Help me understand the board's responsibility is to hire and fire the CEO.
Right.
Didn't they fire her? Didn't they say
no, they did not. She refused to go. And she said that if she did have to go, what she basically said to them, if you push me out before I fix this, I will... I will go to the press and expose everything that happened in terms of the former CEO's legacy.
Yeah, the wrongful termination suit's going to make it all bubble.
That's exactly right. So I'll blow everything up. So they said, fine, we're going. You want us out of here, we'll resign en masse or in a staggered way and let you get this company back. They also didn't want to see all their stock tank. So that was another potent reminder of what had to happen in order for everybody to end well.
Didn't you have like NDA that
you extended away? There's ways of doing it. I mean, it's...
If it comes from a wrongful termination suit,
right.
Discovery...
It's yeah, okay. Everything's available in discovery, and with this debacle, everything would be available in SEC... in the AK and everything else. Robert, did you have another comment?
No, I was just saying when you were talking about the board resigning in mass, as opposed to Frank's comment about compensation and how the board members are being compensated.
Exactly.
Because, you know, they were, it was problematic for them for a whole range of reasons.
Right.
And those that had integrity probably said, gee, we really screwed up and we trusted this guy and we're all, you know, we're all complicit by omission or when this happens, trusting somebody.
And I think the other piece of it is that they believed it was a sinking ship and nobody believed that she could turn it around. So they decided that they should probably get off it and just let her do what she needed to do, not realizing that she would be able to turn it around, stabilize it, and then leave on her own terms.
How long did it turn around?
3 years.
3 years. Okay. So 3 years plus, so she was there 5 years.
Yes.
3 years in and then another 3 years.
Exactly.
So what are the lessons learned for people around this table or people listening to this program if they are CEOs and they're going into a board that has been controlled by the previous CEO? Because that's going to happen.
Absolutely.
What are the lessons that you can take away from this case? I mean, to me, one thing clearly is over and over again just to say, what do you want to see changed? What do you want to see preserved and honored? And then what are the things you don't want touched? And if they say, you know, don't touch this area, don't touch this person, that's
well, there should be an adequate level of board turnover and evidence, right? That might vary depending on the business, but if everybody's been there with the old CEO for 18 years.
Well, in a lot of financial services, and certainly that's the case with community banks, credit unions, you see people never turn over.
Right.
Which is risk.
Which is high risk.
Which is risk. Yeah.
Yeah, but which, and, you know, it goes back to Craig's comment, which is that's what you part of what you negotiate. I mean, do you take a job where everything is stacked against you because you're inheriting a board and a chairman who is embedded in the past? You know, and if they say to you, we want you to take us into the future, but the board is past looking and you're the only person future looking, do you really take that job?
Well, I think that's the number one lesson learned. You ask a question, start back, how eager you are for this job. If you have your feet on the ground when you say, here's some red flags, and you get it worked out up front. If they say, no, he's not leaving, and no, or he's going to leave, but we won't require, he'll leave in 5 years. That's a different job, and you just might want to walk on it.
Wait.
But there's a lot of other elements in that. In that contract negotiations, that would be extensive.
Yes.
Although, true, but easy to say and hard to do. If she had been running a significant division of the company and aspired to the overall leadership position and had a window of opportunity for it, and everybody was probably very encouraging and supportive.
She wasn't internal to the company. She was running a division in another company.
But even so now you have your chance.
Right, that's exactly right.
That's a very difficult thing to walk away from. And even if you see risk, there are 10 other people that will do that job, right? So it's a very hard thing to walk away from.
But is it selling your soul to want it that badly?
Well, and the way I'm thinking
maybe
about this, if I'm being courted by the CEO, and there's a full court press going on,
mm-hmm.
company and this institution really going to figure out, okay, what's going on and what may I may not be able to do. And I may trust this one person to hang my hat on, the one person who says, we can see you in over here, it's going to be great, we love it, it's going to be fine, don't worry about it. I think that asking questions and speaking with other people might be another way to figure out, okay,
what's overcomplicated.
Yeah.
Sometimes simple questions are the best approach. A simple question might be, you know, best practices would indicate that you should step down, both the CEO and as chairman. Help me to understand why you feel it is needed for you to remain. I mean, that's a simple question, but it's open-ended. And I think you can get a lot from that to better make a determination. Or to use that to negotiate to say, interesting. I would still say best practices would indicate. So you brought up a couple points. Maybe we should have it be for a defined period of time, such that, you know, it's not indefinite, et cetera. But I don't know. Hindsight's always 20/20, but you don't know when you're in the thick of it, whether it's the emotional, hey, I want this job, or did I ask the right 52 questions? Sometimes the simplest questions are the best questions, the open-ended questions, to really understand.
If I can,
that is amazing.
If I can piggyback on that, I had a situation where I had a client who was approached about becoming CEO of a wine a vineyard. And it was owned by a venture capital firm. And I told my client, I've got one question I want you to ask. And the question is, on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being never, 10 being always, how open is this venture capitalist to new ideas? And ask everybody that you know who knows this person, go on LinkedIn, find out people who worked with him. Just ask that one question, 0 to 10. And if you get an answer 8, 9, or 10, that should be good. If you get an answer 1, 2, 3, 4, that's definitely bad. And if you get 6, 7, that's borderline. And he asked that question, and very quickly got a response that, no, this VC's already figured out what the business model should be and what the turnaround should be. He's just looking for someone to implement his model. He's not open to new ideas. Never has been, never will be. And I think if she had asked that question of people who've worked at the company, who know the CEO, they probably would have given something like 4, 5, and 6.
It's true. Although you never know. From a personal experience, a company that I was consulting to many years ago, the CEO just was going to do an acquisition, and nobody in the company had acquisition experience. I had acquisition experience. He convinced me to come on board, and I said, I've been a consultant my whole career. I've been consulting to you. I pride myself on always telling the emperor he wears no clothes. And so you're going to have to live with my telling you the truth. No, it's perfect, it's perfect. That's why I want you. Come on board. I finally left the company when he told me, I am so tired of you thinking and asking questions and telling me that this acquisition is not going to work because of 82 things. Your new job is scrubbing toilets. This is a true story. Your new job is scrubbing toilets. Shut your mouth. So needless to say, I left shortly thereafter, and the acquisition tanked for everything I said, and he ended up under SEC investigation. But sometimes what people say, and everybody in the company said, no, he really wants you. He really wants you. Not so much.
Another thing is, you were coming in as a new CEO. Sort of like have strategic audit to develop a strategy, sort of like have an assessment that, say, well, first 100 days, I'm going to develop a thorough assessment of, all the activities and come back to the board with a recommended strategy and steps.
Right.
No,
again, excellent advice in terms of before one takes a position to be sure that can occur. Dave?
Yeah, I just think, in terms of things that we all can learn is, to really trust your gut. I mean, people have a pretty good instinct. something doesn't feel right, trust that and dig in and understand it and not, you know, let it just, you know, sort of be a dark cloud over in the distance that, you know, somebody rains on you. So I think that's a really important lesson.
And it's important that you, that to reinforce that. That's one of the key lessons of all the, we did 50 interviews in our book. And a key lesson was listen to your gut. With the gift of hindsight, virtually everyone we interviewed said, I wish I had listened to my gut.
I'll tell you what's interesting as a new CEO running a company, it's amazing how easy it is to not trust your gut.
Mm-hmm.
Because you wind up with a lot of external ideas, and everyone has an idea. And it's amazing how easy it is to get, and I've had situations already just in our short history. It's a month, right? I wish I could just trust my gut that way.
And it's a fine line of knowing when to do that and when to listen to advisors who have experience and what the balance is between the two.
I was just going to say that, you know, Dave, I think that's excellent advice. I think it would be very difficult to flush this out before you have the job, because the answer is going to be immediately, well, why is it the former CEO standing? Look, at your first-time CEO, he's here to advise you to kind of transition the business. We as a board want to minimize our risk. We want to see a smooth transition. Our investors want to see a smooth transition. This guy has been very successful. But I think it'll be very difficult to get the answers until you're in the job. And chances are the financials up front, that group is going to be buried within some other division. The whole division looks good. Everything looks normal. Offsetting something else that's bad. And it's only once you're in the seat that you're going to be able to start to flush that out. But then you have to dig.
And Joe, to your point, it was intensified by you're a woman who's going to be a CEO in a financial services firm. So having a much loved CEO move into the chairman position to protect you from the slings and arrows that will be coming your way, where people are questioning why you have this job and why I gave it to a woman, makes it even more difficult.
I think at this point, it's 6 o'clock, we should stop it. Elaine has brought copies of her book. She signed the book, if any of you are interested in copies of the book. I've read the book, and it is not easy reading because it's you know, one story after another story of betrayal.
It's one of the most captivating books I've ever
don't
read.
Don't read this book before you go to bed.
But
it does have some really good ideas in terms of how to avoid that, you know, getting taken. We have a perspective about this. It's called the knowledge worker paradox, and I've seen this many times in life sciences, over and over again in higher education,
mm-hmm.
And to a lesser extent in technology. And that is, the paradox is you have extremely bright technical people who can diagnose issues within their technical sphere of competence. What they can't do is that they don't have a language to describe relationships at work. And there's no shared common language to describe relationships at work. Now, if you have an individual contributor who's only doing a job in a cubicle and doesn't have to do it in a team basis, it doesn't make any difference. But increasingly, work is being done in teams. And what I find is how you diagnose your relationships at work is going to depend a lot on your reaction. So if I diagnose our relationships, we're friends. We've been at each other's house. We've met each other's wives. We've gone out for dinner. And then you do something that is totally against my interests, I feel betrayed. Because friends don't do that to friends. And that's a betrayal. On the other hand, Chris we like each other, we go out for drinks together, we've met each other's wives, but my relationship with him, I call him a chum. And a chum is an ally with benefits. And chum is, I like him, but I understand Chris is, he's here for his own gain.
You're expendable.
And the relationship that we have is
allies.
You know, it's an instrumental one to help him, and my relationship is instrumental to help. But we're not friends, because friends they're not instrumental. You're lucky in your life if you've got one or two good friends, and you know that they're always going to be there for you no matter what. An ally, no, it's all contingency. So if Chris and I are allies and then he does something that is not in my interest, I don't feel I'm betrayed. So a lot of this is, how do you diagnose something and have a common language in the company for discussing relationships at work? And I think that's important.
An ally can be an adversary on another issue. You'd be allies on one issue, adversarial on another issue. But friends and enemies are too polarized. And people tend to want their friends to always be loyal. And then if there's someone that they designate as an enemy, even if it's an adversary, but they misconstrue it, they'll never want to work with that person and they'll never see eye to eye.
Yeah, what I saw many times in higher education, well, you know, we've known each other for years, we like each other, we've been out for dinner, so I consider you a friend. Now you do something that's in my interest, you're not a friend, you are an enemy.
Right.
Once I diagnose you as an enemy, then only getting rid of you is that, you know, I want you out of the organization and I won't stop until you're gone. And I've seen that very dysfunctional situation in higher education.
And it's one of the reasons why it's so hard to find people who want to be the chair of their department, because everybody is friends, they're all peers, they're all equals,
yeah.
They're friends, and the minute you become chair, you might have to take action. And then you fear that because chairs are rotating, if you go back to the faculty
yeah.
team, you may have made enemies, and you can never get through that.
Right, that's right.
What about in that situation? And I appreciate the analysis, because I think that's more intense than business, that you use the title for the chair as interim. Does that take some of the...
No, because it's always interim. Everybody knows chairs are rotating. Nobody's a department chair forever.
Because notice what they've done in Washington recently on Trump's team. Interim chief of staff. That goes on down the line.
Everybody knows everything there is interim, too.
Yeah, because everybody's afraid to be purple. That's exactly
right. That's not a tactic. That's realistic.
All right. Better to have a job in Congress for good reason. You're reelected 98% of the time.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Were you able to name names? In the book, or did there?
No, everything is.
It's all.
Yeah, everything is. We changed locations. We changed genders. We changed depending on how panic-stricken people were about their stories.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so every name is anonymous.
Yeah.
So Elaine is from retail. You're from retail. On the 29th of August, we will have Larry Siff, who used to be a partner at Gordon Brothers, which is well known in the retail area, and he's going to be talking about board CEO communications.
Ah.
So it's kind of a very natural bridge between what Elaine's case is and what Larry's going to be doing.
Great. And he's done a lot of startup companies, a lot of internet companies prior to being at Gordon Brothers.
Great. It's a great company.
Hope to see you then. And again, please feel free to share.
It actually is not that depressing a book. I've been getting notes from people who say it's uplifting, because the focus is on survival and resilience. So we tell the story, we tell how it resolved, we tell the lessons. How do you move forward?
Is it like Bad Blood, but just many versions? Have you read the book?
Bad Blood, I got.
Yeah.
That's an interesting book.
That's a fascinating book.
In spite of Larry's
yeah.
tepid review, I'm going to have to.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Contrarian stance.
Or because of it.
So I went out
there
and.
There might be spite in there.
So I went out and got Square, you know, so I'm also now good to go to farmers markets. And I practiced with my husband. He bought stuff before I left the house today, so I could sell
Square.
Something here.
All right.
immediate, if you're on Square, you'll get an immediate
even better,
email.
Do you take cash receipt. Or is that too
I could take cash.
even better is Venmo, right? You don't have cash.
I have Venmo.
Have
I could
Square.
Take Venmo. I can take Venmo.
I'll do Venmo.
Oh, right, yeah.
No fee,
thank
and you.
You
don't have
thank
to bother
you very
with
much.
Cash.
Thanks so much. That was great, and thanks for the sad words.